Hello, everyone. I'm Claudio Mugan, the host of the Speech Inspired podcast. Please subscribe to the channel, leave a comment, and share this interview with your friends. My guest today is Dr. Katie Deming. Katie is a Duke-trained radiation oncologist, former leader in one of the country's largest healthcare systems, inventor, and TEDx speaker who left the conventional medicine at the height of her career, following a near-death experience that changed everything for her personally and professionally. She is now on a mission to create an entirely new approach to healing called conscious medicine, which considers the myriad roots of disease and the role of water as the unifying connector of mind, body, emotion, and spirit. She's also the host of the Born to Heal podcast. Dr. Katie, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Claudio. It's my pleasure to be here.
We're going to talk about so many subjects, and some of them might be controversial, but I'm hoping we're going to find some common ground for sure.
Yeah.
Let's start with your near-death experience, how that came about and why exactly changed your life.
Sure. And actually, so when we describe this, we say a near-death like, because the experience that I had was actually not a near-death experience. It was called a shared death experience, which for your listeners or viewers who are not familiar with that, that is something that is similar to a near-death experience, but happens to persons who are at the scene or connected to someone else who transitions. And I knew nothing about this before it happened to me, but it often happens to healthcare professionals or emergency personnel who are at the scene when someone dies. And basically, what happens is the person who is in the presence of the person who's dying, it has the similar metaphysical experience of the light and the love and, you know, the beauty that people who have near-death experiences, but they didn't actually die themselves and come back. And so this happened to me in the fall of 2020. And what's different about my experience is that most shared death experiences happen where the physician or the healthcare professional is actually physically with the person when they pass. But mine was different because it basically happened to me in meditation. And I knew a woman. So I, at the time, was a physician working in radiation oncology, and I had a colleague who was an administrator, and I was helping her best friend from childhood. I was basically helping my friend who was an administrator who worked with me help her friend who was dying of breast cancer. And her friend was in her early 30s and had a very aggressive form of breast cancer. And I was helping my friend, you know, coach her through how to support her friend. Her friend's name was Misty, and basically helping make sure Misty's wishes were honored and also help my friend cope with the loss of a very young friend. So in your early 30s, you don't have experience, you know, losing people who were, you know, young. And so I was helping her through this process. And what happened was, is that I knew that Misty was near the end of her life, but I didn't know exactly, you know, where she was at. I had spoken to my friend probably a couple weeks before. And one night I was in meditation and I had a woman's voice come to me. And what she said was, "I can't leave, but it's not because of me, it's because of them." And instinctively, I knew in the second that she said it that she was dying and that she was talking about her friends and family that she couldn't let go because of them. And I don't know how I knew that. I just knew that in the moment. And so I said to her, I've taken care of over 5,000 people with cancer in my career, and about 40% of my practice was palliative. So I've been around a lot of death and I've helped a lot of patients through that process. And so I instinctively just said to her, "There's no rush. You know, take your time. I will stay with you. You'll know when it's time and when you're ready." And so I stayed with her in meditation, and the meditation was probably somewhere between 30 and 40 minutes. And At some point during the meditation, I saw that this was Misty, that this was my friend's friend who I had been helping. And I can't tell you what happened through that whole 30 minutes, but at some point during the meditation, I started to feel her pulling up and away from her body. And I heard pops, like a popping of strings, like pop, pop, pop. And I sensed a pulling. And as soon as that happened, it was like the sky above me opened up. And all of a sudden, I was engulfed in just love and light. And she gasped and said, "Oh my gosh, I never had to worry. It's so beautiful." And she was gone. And I was just in this space of absolute love, light that was ineffable. I have no words for what it felt like. It was just indescribable love and beauty. And I knew in this space that what is next for us is more beautiful than we could ever imagine. And this is actually the place of contrast. If people want to talk about like a heaven and a hell, I was like, whatever that is absolute perfection and beauty. And this is actually the challenging place to be. And so I don't know how long I was there because time is doesn't exist is the best way that I can describe it. But when I came back, I had no idea what had just happened. I was so confused because I hadn't been using drugs. I hadn't been drinking. I did not know. And I'd never had an experience like that in my life. And so I went to bed and I did not tell my husband because I thought he would think that I was crazy. I went to sleep. And in the morning, when I woke up, I had a text from my friend. And the text was a photo of Misty. And it said, "Misty died last night. And I want to thank you for all your help." And I didn't even know what to say to her because I was like, I don't know if I do I tell her what happened because I had no idea, but I knew that that text had come as confirmation for me. And so I said, "I know this is a weird question, but you mind telling me what time Misty died?" And her time of death was within 5 minutes of me coming out of meditation. So all of that was confirmation for me that what had happened actually was something. And what happened after that was that I had known starting in about 2019 that something was off in my career as a radiation oncologist. I had sensed that I wasn't supposed to be doing that I was meant to do something different. But it didn't make any sense because I had trained my whole life to become a radiation oncologist. I didn't have my first job until I was 32. And but I had this like just inkling that something was off, that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. And I had these conversations with my husband at the time. And he was like, "Maybe there's something wrong with you because you're great at your job. You have a meaningful job. You treat cancer." I mean, people say like, "It's not like I'm curing cancer." And here I was, "This is my job." He's like, "It doesn't make sense. You have a meaningful job. You're good at your job. It's easy for you. You make good money. You have a nice lifestyle. Maybe something's wrong with you because if you're not happy with what other people would think is like everything you could ever want, maybe there's a problem with you and you're not going to be happy with whatever you get." And so I had internalized that for a while in 2019. And then when this happened, I just knew. I was like, "Okay, now it's clear. I need to go. I don't know what's next," but I knew that I needed to make the transition out of my current career as a radiation oncologist.
Yes, thank you for being so open about this experience and what your thoughts were after the event. And there are so many things to unpack. And I will add something on top of what you said, that you didn't take drugs, you didn't drink. And also, I will say you didn't have the training from school to identify such moments because the medical school won't teach you something like this. So, of course, unless you are so passionate to read outside the curriculum on your own, you won't identify this event as a shared or near-death experience, whatever that experience is. So you are left on your own pretty much. And also, I think you are one of the few, I don't have the statistics, but I think you are one of a few oncologists who somehow cross the line on the other side. And I would like to know, are you still practicing oncology with this new mindset? And how do you approach your patients and with this new mindset and this new experience?
Yes. So I, you know, it took me a few years. That happened in the fall of 2020. And then I ended up actually resigning from my position in the summer of 2022. And the reason why it took me time is one, you know, recruiting doctors into oncology positions takes time. So I wanted to make sure that my clinic and my colleagues could replace me. But then the other piece was that my husband was not supportive of this decision. And I knew that I needed to leave, and I knew that I couldn't just jump into some other training and do some other, you know, type of medicine without taking time. Because what this event did for me was clarified what wasn't right, but it didn't give me the answers to say, all of a sudden I saw this is the way to healing. It just told me what wasn't right for me. And so I knew that I needed to take time off to explore what healing really is. And I also knew from after that, I had this sense that I had studied what makes you sick. So everything in medical school that we're taught is taught through the lens of pathology. We're taught what goes wrong in the body and how to use medications, or in my case, radiation, to deal with that. But I was never taught what creates true health and what does it look like to be truly healthy. And so I had decided to leave and take time to really research what does it mean to be healthy? What creates true health in the body? And so starting in 2020, I started doing this other research. And then I also started to explore all of these different ways of healing, because I realized when I started to open my eyes, there was so much that I hadn't been taught in medicine. And I started to research the impact of emotional trauma on the creation of illness in the body, the role of our mind, and spiritual aspects of healing. And the thing that I came to was that any kind of healing requires a holistic approach, which includes physical practices, which is, you know, most of people understand that, but it also needed to include emotional, mental, and spiritual practice as well. And so I spent a few years really diving into all the different areas. And then eventually in the fall of 2023, I launched an integrative practice that was focused on combining physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual practices into the healing of cancer.
So what do you think is the reason now, because you're inside now and you are outside, what's the reason for the medical practice and for the universities and for anyone which is in decision maker in the medical field not to integrate a more holistic approach to health? Because in the end, we have to find the root cause and then treat it, not just treat the end result.
Sure. Well, I think I'm going to start with the statement where you said, you know, I inside the system and outside the system. One of the things that I couldn't see until I got out and actually quit, I think actually quitting was one of the best things that I had done, because when, in addition to practicing radiation oncology, I was also a healthcare leader. So I had designed, led, and run cancer services end to end, from prevention, screening, diagnosis through treatment, and end of life or survivorship. So I really had a broad understanding of the way Western oncology worked. But it wasn't until I left that I could actually see what it was that I had been in. It's almost like they say, you know, when you're inside the bottle, you can't read the label on the outside of the bottle. So now that I'm outside the bottle, I see that the label on the front of the bottle is that this is about illness and using medication. So the whole system works exactly as it's designed. It works as it's designed, and it is designed not to treat the root cause, not to get people truly well, because there's not money in that, Right? The things that make us well are often not that expensive and don't require us taking medications for the rest of our life. And this is also one of the things that happened when I resigned was that my chief of radiation oncology, who also had taken over as the cancer service line, so running end-to-end cancer services, was like, no, you can't leave. Like, we can't lose you. And she's like, what do you want to do? You don't want to practice radiation oncology? Tell me what you want to do. And so I told her I wanted to do integrative medicine, but I didn't want to do it kind of the way that it's been like kind of cookie cutter that I've seen in other traditional health systems. I really wanted to address this idea of root cause and get under the problem. And so she was like, let's create a business case, present it to the administrators to see if we can get support for a salary to pay you to do this. And ultimately, we spent several months building that, and ultimately the administrators didn't fund it, which I think was also a good thing that didn't happen. I think all of this was synchronistic. It happened in exactly the way that it was meant to happen. But it's like, I don't think that integrative oncology plugged into the conventional Western medical system is ever going to solve the problem, because the incentives that drive Western medicine are contrary to a true healing and creating wellness. I think those two things are kind of contrary to each other, and the people do it, right? So there are cancer centers that have integrative approaches, but as you start to understand how the body heals, especially with cancer, if you think about cancer, you've got an imbalance of toxicity in the body, whether that's physical toxicity of, let's just say environmental toxins or emotional toxins or mental toxins. You've got toxicity in the body and you've got a lowered immune system, right? Those are the two things that are happening when you have cancer. Well, what happens when you give chemotherapy or radiation? And basically, you have an increase in toxicity in the body. You're adding toxins to the body and you're decreasing the immune system. And when I started to understand that, I was like, I do support people who are having conventional therapy, because if people are having conventional therapy, there is a benefit of adding all this stuff, the kind of holistic approach. But it's then after they finish treatment, it's like focusing on detoxifying that and getting that all out of the system. And so I think that there's this underlying premise in Western medicine and oncology that is counter to the approach that I now am understanding is the way the body heals and the way we create health.
Yes, and I really, really appreciate your honesty and the fact that you put everything forward. And I would love to see more oncologists listening to you and to this interview, and give a second thought of what they're doing. And I'll give you an example. Last week, we lost a very close friend to brain cancer. He fought for 3 years. It was very aggressive. But we saw him like a month after the first surgery. He was very disoriented. He needed help to move around. And then his wife was able to get some organic CBT and gave it to him. A month later, he was a changed person. He was walking by himself. He was able to go down the stairs. He was talking. He was making jokes. He wasn't fully functional, but at least with CBT, which wasn't given by the hospital, he was administering that substance while the doctors were looking on, the other way. So she was able to maintain his awareness and his certain level of health for a number of years with that. In the end, the cancer was much more aggressive, but it showed that if you use something which is not part of the procedure, the medical procedure can also help. And based, I'm not a medical practitioner. I've never studied the medicine, but doing my interaction with previous guests and what I'm doing my own research, I can name four or five methodologies that can, let's say, fight cancer, like hyperbaric chamber, oxygen therapy, sound therapy, energy healing. So I don't think any doctor, oncologist in this particular case, is willing to look at any alternative methods. Am I right?
Well, I think the reason why traditional oncologists are not as open to these other healing modalities is that they are not taught anything about it, right? They are taught a specific system, and then also they are indoctrinated into a very hierarchical way of thinking, and that you always are just looking to the peer-reviewed, randomized data that is done by the it's basically big, large trials. And the problem is that there's not money in these other modalities to do these big trials. So then they poo-poo it, but it's not because there's not validity there. It's just because it doesn't fit into the system that they've been not only educated into, but conditioned into, really conditioned into thinking a very specific way. And I think that more doctors are open to like diet, but like cancer, brain cancer is a great example where, with a metabolic approach of using a ketogenic diet, basically people can arrest their cancer with that. And I think doctors are starting to wake up to that. But even that, there's not big studies because there's not a lot of money in that. And so one of the things that I have is a lot of compassion for the doctors, because I don't think it's the doctor's fault. I think all the doctors that I know went into medicine because they wanted to help people, but then now they've become a product of a system that they didn't even know that they were signing up for. And so then it's like you have your blinders on, and this is what you know. And then also it's kind of scary because it's a wide, wide world. I mean, one of the things that I've learned from moving from the conventional space into the holistic, alternative, complementary space, whatever you want to call it is a confusing world out there because there isn't the data. And because one practitioner says this is the absolute answer, and another person says this is the answer, and they're completely contrary. It's like, how do you even know where to start and how to evaluate it? And that's been one of the things that I've recognized is it's confusing to kind of sift through all of the possible options that are out there.
Yes, and to me, if a doctor is successful on fighting a specific disease, cancer in this situation, I know with, let's say, 90% or 90%, 95% certainty that the government will go after the doctor. And the point in case is Dr. Brzezinski from Dallas, I think. He had a very successful practice. He was healing 90 plus percent of his patients. And they took him to cleaners like the government. They, lawsuit after lawsuit. In the end, I think he won. But if you go through this type of ordeal and energy dissipation, and at the end you say, you know what, forget about it. I'm done with it because they're going to find something else to come after me. So there is not even a desire to help the doctors who develop new methodologies, as you said, yeah.
Yeah, well, and you bring up a good point because by one of the things of going outside the system is you're unprotected. And not only are you unprotected by the system, you then become a target because the system is designed by very powerful entities that are making a lot of money off of this structure. And when you have people who are demonstrating and actually maybe doing the research and having the results, that those people become targets to be taken out because they don't want that out there.
Yes, you're right. And something else bothers my mind, and I cannot, comprehend. You guys, doctors in general, are very smart people. You learn a lot. You work hard to get where you are these days. And you just mentioned that out of the 50,000 patients, 40% went into palliative care, and I assume that the other 60% they had a low rate of survival. So if this is the percentage of surviving patients, don't you, or in general, wonder, am I doing the right thing? Are we applying the right strategy? So the change should come from within, where the doctors should get together and say, guys, something is wrong. Our patients are dying. Doesn't matter what procedure, what process. It doesn't matter if it takes 2 years or 3 years or five. In the end, they are gone. So should we look at other options and then go back to the management of the hospital and go up the ladder?
Well, I just so I want to clarify a couple of things there in the numbers. So it's about 5,000 or over 5,000 patients that I've cared for, not 50,000. But then the other piece is that so 60% of my practice was with curative intent, meaning that I saw people who had stage one, two, three types of cancer. And then 40% of the people that I saw when they came to see me, they had stage four cancer. And the presumption was is that they're not going to be cured. So for the 60%, yeah, those patients, most of them were going on to live healthy lives for the rest of their life, although they had side effects and complications related to the treatment. But 60% of the time, those people were being treated with curative intent, right? Now, of course, some of those people had recurrences and that kind of thing. And I do think that the outcomes are not as good as we say they are. But I think within the system, the doctors aren't seeing that. They're seeing advances with these new medications. We're making people live longer with, you know, people with stage four cancer. It used to be a death sentence. Now they can live for 5 years. Never mind, we're bankrupting the system by giving them medications that are thousands of dollars every month. And maybe they only live a couple months longer and sicker during the process. But I don't know that the doctors are seeing that per se, that piece of it. But I will say the part that I was seeing before I had that shared death experience, and this was that it came to me when I was at a meditation retreat. And I don't know when it was, like 2016 or 17. I was with a girlfriend who's a GYN oncologist, which is basically an oncologist who cares for people with gynecologic cancers. And there was this story, and it was a parable of the river. And in the parable, they described that there was a village that lived along the river. And one day there was a body that was floating in the river. The person was drowning. And so the villagers, you know, sent someone out, rescued the body, and got them onto dry land. And then the next day there were two bodies floating in the river and they rescued them. And then next day, four, and then eight, and 16, and so on and so on. It just kept doubling. And pretty soon this village was like expert at rescuing people off the river. They had like speed boats and all this like elaborate rescue equipment. And the village elders were praising the villagers for their amazing work rescuing all the people off the river. And I looked at my friend and I said, "This is Western oncology, and we are the glorified rescue workers working on the river, just pulling people out." But I was like, "What the heck is happening upstream? Why is everyone falling in the river?" And then why, when I get them onto dry land, am I not talking to them about why they got cancer and helping them prevent it from coming back? And so, you know, but I think that I was starting to have awarenesses and also was willing to go there because I think that a lot of other doctors are not as willing to question things as I am. And even for me, it took this like very dramatic experience because I had the other people in my life telling me, "Why would you do this? Why would you blow up your life? You make $500,000 a year. We have a beautiful life. You want to just give that up for like what?" So I think that a lot of doctors, there's no incentive for them to question it. And I think that when you start questioning, it's kind of scary because, well, what are you going to do? You've trained your whole life. And I had, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in student debt that I was paying back. And the doctors that are younger than me have more than that. So I just think that there's a lot of competing things happening for the doctors that are in the system. And then even for me, it wasn't until I got outside that I could actually start to see it more clearly.
Yes. And because you just mentioned about your colleagues, are you considered the black sheep of the oncology by your colleagues?
Well, so this is an interesting question. My colleagues haven't said much to me, but I think they're watching. You know, the thing that I know is that people are watching because I hear them say, "Oh, I saw," but they're not liking my stuff. They're not commenting on it, but I know they're watching. And the other thing, though, that I have in my career that maybe someone who just practiced wouldn't have is that I served at a very high level. Like, and also I was always very forward-thinking. And right before my experience, the shared death experience, in 2020, I had been nominated to become the national medical director for cancer care for the organization which I was in, which is one of the largest healthcare organizations in the United States. And in that position, I would have been responsible for 12 million Americans, cancer prevention, screening, diagnosis, treatment, the whole thing. And in the end, I made it to like the top two. So it was me and another woman. And ultimately, she got the position. And I knew that also happened for a reason, you know. But because I had that experience, and also I was thought of as someone as kind of forward thinking, I think the colleagues are kind of intrigued because they know in other ways I had been ahead of what we had been doing, you know, and looking ahead. And so I think that I think I make them all nervous. I do think that that's true, but I also think they're watching. And that's part of why my podcast, I have a podcast called Born to Heal, and I had launched it back in, I think it was 2021. And I did short format to like help people with cancer, you know, with mindset and these other things, emotional processing and managing fear, and had done that. But I just brought the podcast back, and I'm intentionally using that to bring other health professionals along with me. And in the beginning, so I just launched on February 13th, and the first couple episodes are me sharing my experience of why I left and then walking through that, you know, process of leaving, which was kind of messy, to be honest. And then now I'm bringing on experts because I'm a student. Like, but I'm in a student in a totally different way. And so, like, Gerald Pollack was my first guest. And then Thomas Seyfried, who, you know, cancer is a metabolic condition, was my second guest. I have Tom Cowan. So I'm bringing on these people to expose those people who knew me before to, like, you know, plant the seed just so that they can hear this different way of thinking.
Yes, very smart way to do it. And I can tell you that we know at least two medical professionals who were practicing in Ontario, Canada. They didn't renew their license. One of them moved out of the province because more procedures, which were healthy and beneficial to their patients, were forbidden pretty much. And they found loopholes to be able to practice, make a living, and support their patients. So there are doctors like you and medical professionals like yourself who are not willing to bow to the system, and they will find ways to practice and again support their patients.
Yeah.
And now let's expand on to what you consider the conscious oncology practice.
Yeah. Well, when I started my practice, it was, you know, basically an integrative practice and looking at bringing in this holistic approach of mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical healing. And but I came across Gerald Pollack, Tom Cowan, actually, and Gerald Pollack's work. And the two of those things together brought me into the science of water. And when I had first launched my practice, I knew you needed this comprehensive approach, but I didn't know why. I mean, in some ways, you're like, okay, well, of course we need these other approaches because not only do we have a physical body, but we have a mental, emotional, and spiritual body as well. But there wasn't like a science that I could unify all that, where I was like, okay, this makes sense to me why we need this. But when I started to understand the fourth phase of water and Gerald Pollack's work, and then what Tom Cowan writes about in Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, as well as Cancer and the New Biology of Water, I started to see how water is the unifying science. That when you understand the fourth phase of water and the way we're intended to hold water in our body and the inputs that affect the water in our body, it gives an answer for why we need all of these things. Because the physical things that we do, right, the water that we drink, the food that we eat, the connection to the sun, to the earth, to other beings, whether they're other humans or other animals, those affect the way we hold our water. And we need those inputs. We're designed for those inputs. And then emotions affect our water, and our thoughts affect our water, and consciousness affects our water. And I didn't know that I was cleaning up my water. You know, now I think of our bodies as a body of water. And that's like we are walking bodies of water. 99.9% of the molecules in our body are water. And as what I had been doing, the practices that I had started doing were basically cleaning out my water. And what I found was that the more I cleaned out my water, the more I became a clear channel for higher levels of consciousness. And this was one of the things that ties back to that shared death experience. I didn't know what had happened to me. Like, you know, that was another thing where I was kind of confused. I'm like, I know I'm different, but I don't know how I'm different. I don't know what happened and why it changed me. But when I was reading David Hawkins' work and his book, Power Versus Force, he talks about how people who have near-death experiences are just bathed in super high frequency when they go through that experience, and it tunes them in a different way. And so I realized that I was tuned already to the information, but as I've cleaned out my water, it's helped me become a clearer channel for higher levels of consciousness. And that's why I don't use the term integrative oncology, because I use it because it's like what people think of as a holistic practitioner, someone who moves from Western oncology, you know, as an oncologist into an alternative space. I think it makes sense saying integrative oncologist, but the difference that I make from my practice to a traditional integrative oncology practice is integrative oncology can mean so many different things. You could just focus on diet. So you could just do, you know, metabolic approach to cancer, and that's an integrative oncologist. You could just do mindset work, or you could just have, you know, supplements. All of that is considered integrative oncology. To me, conscious medicine and conscious oncology is looking at the unifying science of water and recognizing that you don't just need one of these inputs, you need all four of them, and you need all of them working together to help people become whole. And in doing that, they also are going to wake up to be better tuned to truth for them. I don't know what the truth is. And the one thing that I know is like the more that I know, the less I know, but it's like people become more resonant to the truth for them. And that's what I want to help people find is their truth so that they can live in a life that's authentic to who they were born to be.
Yes, and just to disclose, in fact, water is the common element who brought us together on this interview, because you realize that I wrote two books about water, and in fact, Dr. Gerald Pollack was gracious to write the foreword to the anthology I edited and published back in 2022, Love Letters to Water. And he mentioned the exclusion zone, which is the fourth stage of water, and he talked to you about that. So, if you have to summarize it, how would you say that the easy water will help with, let's say, prevent cancer or cure cancer?
Sure. Well, do you mind? Can I just explain what exclusion zone water is for
Please.
your listeners? Or okay, so the studies that Gerald Pollack did that really describe this were he took a beaker of water, so you can imagine like a big bucket of water, clear bucket of water, and then he suspended a tube in the water, and the tube was open on either end. So you could imagine like a test tube, but it's open on either end, and it was suspended horizontally in the water. And what he found was that the water started moving through the tube, which doesn't make any sense because you're like, well, there's no battery or power source connected to this beaker of water. How is the water moving? And then when he put the beaker of water in a lead box, the water stopped moving. And ultimately, what he found was that what was happening is that the tube that was in the water was a hydrophilic surface, just meaning water loving. Hydrophilic just means water loving. And basically, along a water loving surface, the regular water that we think of actually starts to create layers of structured water that is more like a crystalline form or a gel phase of the water. And it creates this layer of water that is in this different phase. And this is where that fourth phase of water, that name comes from, is that we think of water as just liquid, solid as an ice, or vapor steam. But what he found was that the water, when it comes into contact with a hydrophilic surface and also the other conditions are right, it creates this fourth phase of water. And that fourth phase of water is charged negatively, which is different. So it has a negative charge as compared to like regular bulk water, which has a positive charge. And this differential in charge between that exclusion zone or fourth phase of water layer and the water that's just in the beaker basically creates a charge differential and that makes the water move. And that's the kind of source of what's making the water move in there. And the reason why it moves when it's just out, but it stops moving in a lead box is that the input that helps facilitate this formation of this easy water is infrared. And our most powerful source of infrared is from the sun, but then also we're surrounded by infrared, and your pets are a source of infrared. Other people are a source of infrared. Our hands, so laying on of hands is one of the reasons why, healing with the hands works is because you're basically adding infrared. So that's the experiment. And then the thing that actually brought me onto this was through Tom Cowan. So I have a boyfriend. So my husband and I went through divorce in 2022, and I started dating someone who is a professional cyclist. And he was retired when I met him, but super fit, like the fittest person I've ever met. And he had retired from cycling because he had heart failure. And he was diagnosed with heart failure the month after he won a state championships. He was 50 years old, and he won a race that was not only did he win the over 50 category, but he won the over 35 category, and he won the pro category. And then a month later, he went in. He basically had had an EKG at his yearly physical, and his doctor had been checking his EKG because he had a heart arrhythmia that was just like stable through his whole life, but they were just keeping a check on this. And they had sent him for an echocardiogram because the EKG showed a change. And when he went in for that echocardiogram, he had just ridden like the day before, like 60 miles, had been training. He feels fine. The only symptom that maybe he has is he says, like, when he pushed past 100% in a professional cycling race, he would feel a little short of breath. Well, that's really not a symptom, right? It's like pretty normal for someone to experience. But basically, he went in to get this echocardiogram, and the technician turned completely ashen, walked out. The next thing he knew, he was being put in a defibrillating vest and told, "You're in heart failure. Your ejection fraction is 15%. You're never getting on a bicycle. We're not even sure like you can walk, like that we're worried about you walking around. So you have to wear this vest." And they were like, "When did your symptoms start?" He's like, "What symptoms? Like, I don't, what are you talking about?" Like, they were like, "Well, what did you feel like after you rode your bike yesterday?" He's like, "Great." And to me, this made no sense because as a doctor, I knew someone in heart failure with an ejection fraction of 15% can barely get out of bed and walk to the bathroom, let alone to the mailbox. The idea of this person riding a bicycle at all, let alone winning a professional race, just like completely blew my mind. And so I was just looking, I was at a, like looking through a conference, and I saw a keynote speech by Tom Cowan. And so then I was looking into his other stuff, and I saw he had a book that was called Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. And on the front of the book, it says, "The heart is not a pump." And I was like, "I got to read this because I think this explains this like strange freak of nature that I'm seeing in my real life." And so I read that book, and in that book, it describes that actually the way that the blood moves through our cardiovascular system is not related to the heart pushing the blood, but actually related to easy water or the fourth phase of the water. And basically, the vessels are hydrophilic surfaces, a lot like that tube. And basically, easy water, when we are getting the right inputs, easy water cr is created along the vessels. And that charge differential of the negative charge of the easy layer versus the blood propels the blood through the circulatory system. And when I read that, it just made so much sense that I was like, "Oh, I get it." And then the heart is more of a vortexing mechanism than a pushing. And this makes sense because blood vessels, like in the capillaries, which are the smallest blood vessels in the body, their diameter is the same size as the blood vessels. And if you think about it, if the heart was really pushing, this through the blood vessels. Number one, your heart is up here at the top of the system, right? And then the blood goes out into the aorta, into the arteries, the smaller arteries, into the capillaries. And then it basically stops in the capillaries to offload oxygen and then take up the toxins. And then it comes back up. And you're like, well,
Exactly.
from a mechanical standpoint, you're like, the heart should be at the bottom, not at the top of this system, right? And if it was really pushing with force, you would be shearing red blood cells because the size of the capillaries compared to the blood cells just doesn't make sense. So anyway, when I started to understand that, I was like, okay, this makes sense. And this water thing is like fascinating me. And then I read, it's interesting that I came across Tom Cowan's heart book before I came across, he has a book about cancer and water too. So the next book that I read was about cancer and water. And in this book, what he describes is that not only is easy water important for the flow of blood through our circulatory system, but the water that we hold in our cells, like we talked about before, it's 99.9% of the molecules in our body are water, that the water that we hold in the tissues is also easy water. And he described, you know, as an ER physician, he said people would come in with a gunshot wound or a stabbing. It's like, if we're 99% water, why are we not like squirting water all over the place? It's because the water that we hold in our tissues is this fourth phase of water when we're healthy. And that it described that the formation of easy water in our tissues is related to the function of mitochondria and production of ATP. And if you have abnormally functioning mitochondria, you're not basically structuring the water in your cells. And ultimately, you know, anaerobic glycolysis, there's a shift in the metabolism. And then anaerobic glycolysis or fermentation, which is the sole form of respiration that cancer cells use, is even less efficient at creating ATP. You have like basically one-ninth amount of the ATP from fermentation that you do from oxidative phosphorylation that uses the mitochondria. And so basically, cancer cells are a loss of this easy water. And also, they're starved. They're just pulling sugar from everywhere that they can to create the ATP. And so then they become a parasite on the system and creating, you know, basically, they're sacrificing the organism to like survive themselves. And he showed that, like, the Gerson diet, which is a diet that there's a lot of juicing and that kind of thing that's used for cancer, that actually what the Gerson diet was doing was modulating the charge across the cell, which actually ties into the formation of easy water. And so, as I started to see all of these pieces, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. So, the way that we restore health in the body is by restoring the easy water. And then, you know, through that, I started looking into the work of Veda Austin and, you know, consciousness that affects the water. And I already knew about Emoto's work on emotions affecting the water. And so this was just, it started, the light bulb started to go off for me. And I was like, you know, like I said, now I don't really learn or look for information to like study it and just consume it. I'm looking for resonance. Like, does this resonate with me? And like, my whole body just lit up when I was reading this. And as I've dove into it, it makes so much sense for me, that the restoration of the easy water is the way that we heal. And it's not just cancer, it's, you know, all the conditions that we're seeing, obesity, diabetes, all these things. We have poorly functioning mitochondria, which are, you know, is affecting the way we hold the water in our cells, you know, and we're not getting contact with the sun. We're being told to stay out of the sun. We're not connecting with the earth. We're not connecting with the animals. It's like all these things that we were designed to connect with because this is the environment that we were designed to live in. We've kind of separated ourselves. And then, you know, the things of modern society, like cell phones and 5G, all basically negatively impact the water that we hold. So, starting to make sense to me why we're getting so sick and what we need to do to get better as a society.
Yes, and it's interesting that you mentioned Veda Austin. She's part of the anthology, and I'm familiar with her work. And I consider, in fact, that she took Masaru Emoto's work to the next level by
Yes.
imprinting images into the water, or waters, you know, getting the memory of those sounds and the images it was exposed to. So that was quite interesting. And in fact, I don't know if you are aware, Masaru Emoto did develop a technology, Hatto, which scans your body and creates codes based on what it finds as a resonance in your body. It works with quantum technology and generates codes. And those codes then will be imprinted into a bottle of water. And you drink that water over a period of 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So we are working as a family with that technology, and we are testing it on close friends.
I love that. It's Hato, HATO.
D-O.
Oh, DO,
Yeah, I think it's
HATO.
water in Japanese.
Okay. I'm going to check that out. I didn't know
So,
that.
yeah, so his son, Hiro, took over the research, and he developed more into this technology. There are one for professional use and one for personal use. There are two different type of devices with enhanced capabilities. So
Awesome.
also we can apply water, but also we need to change our diet. We need to change our habits. Otherwise, we won't have, at least in my opinion, we won't have permanent changes, health changes, and structural changes in our bodies.
Yeah, well, and I think this is one of the big misconceptions. When you start to talk about water, people think just about the drinking the water that we drink. And it's important. I think the most important thing is that we drink clean water, but drinking structured water is great. But our body, even if we didn't drink structured water, our body creates the structured water in our cells if we have the right inputs. And these, like you said, eating a low carbohydrate diet that supports the mitochondrial function is going to support this and then the other practices.
Yes. We all have to work on it. And I have a prediction that within 10 years, a lot of people will be so awake to a new type of diet and energy healing and breath work and other healing methodologies that they won't go to the doctor anymore. They will just go to alternative practitioners like yourself and, nutritionists and shamans and energy healers. And they will find much more rapid and benefits on their health.
I love that prediction.
Dr. Katie, I would like to talk about Toltec teachings. You're exposed to such teachings, and how did you find them, and how did you evolve from there?
Oh, so this is so interesting. I have not been asked this in a public setting. So, I was actually my shared death experience ties into this as well. So I didn't know, but the week that that happened to me, I had joined a coaching program that was online. And the person who ran the coaching program's brother-in-law was a shaman. And I didn't know what that meant. And I didn't know, I think that there's so many things that, like, what does that really mean? And, but basically, he was holding the frequency of that group. And when I came in, I was very sensitive to frequency. And I think that's what opened me to that experience. And so I, basically started having my own awakening. And then I got on the list for this person. And, as like, but I didn't know what he did. I didn't know how any of that worked. And basically, I had signed up, and when you work with him, that it's like you do a call, and basically, he's speaking in, he's speaking to you in English, but it's all coded. So what you receive is based on your frequency. So you do one call, and then basically you work on, he works on your etheric body through the elements, through candle ceremonies that use water, fire, and different herbs in the water. And basically, the idea is to clear out your etheric body to just make you clearer, because from this lifetime or other lifetimes, we can develop tears in our etheric body. And so I was doing that work. And at some point, I ended up meeting this person's wife. And it was kind of like, I didn't know that she doesn't really meet with people. And I happened to be with several other women, and they had been working with him already, and I hadn't had my call. I'd been on the wait list, because the wait list now is like, I don't, they stopped taking people. It's like 4 years or something to get in, but at the time it was like 2 years, so I was like a year into the wait list or something. Anyway, I met with his wife, and when his wife sat down to start talking to us, all of a sudden I could see coming through her, like it was almost like a panther, but it was like male energy just coming through, and it was like a male talking to me, and I felt the love of what was I experienced during my shared death experience. And after that experience, after, you know, she talked for a while, and then I was like, okay, this person, and I hadn't had my call yet. This person is not like the rest of us. This person is holding a frequency that is just like what is outside of this veil and this reality. And so I knew that this person was someone very different from anyone that I had ever encountered. And then ultimately I had my call, and normally people don't meet with him in person. There are very few people who meet with him in person, but ultimately I ended up meeting with him in person and apprenticing and mentoring in person. And this person is, if you're familiar with the Carlos Castaneda books,
Yes.
Carlos Castaneda wrote the books about Don Juan, teachings of Don Juan. And this person, well, let me explain. The Carlos Castaneda didn't write those books. And I think a lot of people sense that, you know, the first four books were very on point, and then Carlos started, they started to not all make sense with what the initial books had in them. And then he was doing some weird things that, you know, were questionable, that didn't fit with the things that he, if he had really been that apprentice. And what I learned was that this person that now I was interacting with was actually the person who was the apprentice of Don Juan, and that he had sold, that actually the apprentice, all of that stuff he had written, his experience of apprenticing with Don Juan, but it was when he was like 12 years old, between 12 and 14 years old. And Carlos had said, nobody's going to believe that a 14-year-old went through all of this, taking, eating all of that, you know, plant medicine and doing just all that crazy stuff. Like, no one's going to believe that a child experienced that. And so Carlos made himself the apprentice in those books. But this is the way shamans are trained, is when they're, you know, 13 is basically, you know, they're experiencing all this stuff, and they are trained by a benefactor. And so I have been studying Toltec wisdom through this person, but it's not, when you say study, everything is coded. So we will, you know, I will meet with him, and I'll receive certain information, but then I'll listen back to the recording several months later. And as my frequency changes, I hear even more information. And so, you know, and it's a very different type of mentorship. It's never telling me what to do, it's sharing things, and then it's my job to put the pieces together and basically healing my light body so that I can become a clearer channel to receive information and then put the story together myself. And it's also not an accident. So people, you would never find this person, you know, it's when people talk about going to see a shaman, it's like the real shamans don't work out in public, they work in the background. And that it makes sense also at this time on the planet that we have, you know, people who are more illuminated that are here doing work that I can't even tell you the work. You know, the stuff that he does with me and a few other people is just like a tiny piece. A lot of the stuff is cosmological, you know, working on a planetary level. And so it's been a very humbling path for me. And it's interesting, you're the first, I've not talked about this publicly at all. So, anyway.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And I'm going to ask you and the next daring question. Has plant medicine been part of your training yet?
No. So
No.
no, and that is actually one of the things that he ingested so much so that we don't have to, that in this timeline, that plant medicine can be dangerous, because if someone doesn't know what they're doing, it can mess up your fibers of your light body. And that's what you hear people who have a bad trip and they come back and they're like just totally askew. And so basically, we've never been told you can't do it, but he explains that there is significant risk if you do that with someone who cannot see the light body and doesn't really know what they are doing and trained in that way. And so for me personally, I will never do plant medicine in this lifetime. And that during dream time, you basically can access that level of information, and especially with my connection through him, that I don't need to do that.
Yeah, that's comforting. That's as long as you can access and have the same connectivity without plant medicine, that's amazing. Dr. Katie, other than meditation, do you have any other daily spiritual practice?
Yes, and I can't share all of them. But I definitely spend time in meditation. Connecting with the water is a spiritual practice. So the first thing that I do in the morning is connect with water and drink water. They're physical practices that actually now, and it's funny because the water stuff, he's been telling me about the water, but I didn't get what he was saying about water because my frequency wasn't there yet. But it's like the practices of, using infrared sauna, for the infrared inputs and the way that we eat. And, I think the biggest thing for me is living my life in a way that I'm practicing love in everything that I do, So there's that. Do breath work. Do breath work in the sauna and visualization.
Thank you. And are there any other services you like to mention so people can reach out to you when they are in need?
Sure. So I offer a free workshop that I'm hosting it live on March 5th, but then it'll be recorded on my website. You can find that at katiedeming.com. I also offer one-on-one support for people through cancer or other health conditions. And, also teaching people. So I have online programs around teaching people how to create health in the body.
Thank you. We are approaching the end of the interview. Any final thoughts?
No, I think that that's it. It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, first of all, for crossing the line and coming on our side, on the positive side, the loving side, where there are no boundaries between us and our, brothers and sisters, and we see things with from a different perspective. And that's encouraging because more medical professionals should and could cross that line and see everything from outside the bottle, as you said.
Well, and I think more are coming. I think this is the time that we're living in, that the frequencies and irradiation that is happening on the planet is such that more and more people are waking up, and we need the doctors, we need the people who, know the inside of the system to come out. And I do think that that's happening. And that's why I have so much compassion, and I'm not, kind of incredulous towards doctors who are still in the system. And I think in the health freedom space, you see a lot of that. They're like, "You're so stupid. How could you not see it?" But it's like, until you see it, you can't see it. So it's like having compassion for them and then bringing them along is, part of what I'm hoping to do.
Yes. Once again, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And to my viewers, thank you for watching. Like it, share it, leave a comment. Visit claudiumurgan.com and spiritually inspired.ca. And until next time, love and gratitude.